Welcome to Homefront Rising, the U.S. Tour of Duty podcast. And the Homefront is indeed rising, thanks largely to some great work being done by veterans and their allies. And nobody is doing better work lately than our guest, Scott Ritter. Welcome back to the program, Scott. How are you?
I'm doing great, thanks. Thanks for having me.
Well, you're very welcome. I had an epiphany yesterday, Scott, I want to share with you. Yes, I know big words, epiphany. The epiphany was, it's better when you introduce yourself than when the host does it. And previously, I've been watching you on some of these other interviews you've been doing, and when the host says, hey, introduce yourself, tell us what your credentials are, you know, you tend to chuckle a little bit. I'm not quite sure what's behind that chuckle. But I've been thinking, hey, that's the host's job. Why are they asking him to do it? But then I watched myself back from the last interview, and I sounded lame. It's actually better when you introduce yourself. So may I do what the other hosts have been doing and ask you very politely, would you mind introducing yourself and stating your great credentials?
Well, I chuckle because it's embarrassing. I mean, you know, nobody wants to come off as a braggart, and the last thing I am is a braggart. I had a, I was blessed with a military career that was full of opportunity, but it was a serendipitous opportunity, meaning that the talent didn't rise to the top. The talent was just shown through an open door and told to do a job. I was commissioned in the Marine Corps in 1984. I had a degree in Russian history, military history specialty. And because of that and 2 years of Russian language, I was Russian language, by the way, tempered by football and beer, so it wasn't fluent. But I was not just commissioned in the Marine Corps, but I was directly accessed into the intelligence occupation specialty. Normally, you don't get that. You have to serve 3 to 5 years in the combat arms before they allow you to do a lateral move into intelligence. I was actually the first Marine officer allowed to directly access. And the Marine Corps, I think my career happened because the Marine Corps didn't know what to do with me. They didn't know what to do with an intelligence lieutenant with no experience in anything except a degree that said he's a Russian area expert. But I spent 2.5 years in 29 Palms, California. This is in the mid-1980s. And Cold War was red hot. And our enemy that we were trained to fight was the Soviet Army. And I spent 2.5 years perfecting the skill set necessary to prevail in combat over the Soviets, which meant learning maneuver warfare, learning combined arms warfare, and learning how to fight from a position of numerical inferiority. So shooting, moving, and communicating was the key to survival. And I spent 2.5 years doing this. And that meant spending between 250 plus days a year in the field. Back then, training was training. We didn't have some of the administrative shackles that are put on people in the modern military. We got to train. It was live fire training. We're shooting a lot of live ammunition, a very innovative training, very realistic training, and very demanding training where we actually tried to fail. We tried to push ourselves so hard that we failed so that we learned what our failures were so we could adapt so that we didn't fail if we ever had to go to war. Fortunately, we never did have to go to war. I finished that two and a half years and thought I was going to go on with another job in the Marine Corps. Would have been tip of the spear work, ready to fight, expeditionary warfare, etc. But instead, Mikhail Gorbachev and Ronald Reagan signed the Intermediate Nuclear Forces Treaty in December 1987. And the Marine Corps was tasked with providing Russian-speaking officers at the grade of lieutenant colonel and major to this new organization called the On-Site Inspection Agency, a Department of Defense agency created to implement this INF treaty. Unfortunately for the Marine Corps and the world, they didn't have any. And they kept working their way down the chain. They had a captain at the White House hotline who spoke the Russian with the Russian Nuclear Risk Reduction Center, but he got sent off to a different job. So they came down to me and they pulled my name out of a hat. They saw that I had this Russian history background and my transcript said 2 years of Russian. And so I was recruited. I was sent to do this new job. Instead of killing the Russians, I was hugging them. We were working on disarming two classes of nuclear weapons that were threatening international peace and security. I worked inside the Soviet Union, outside a missile factory in a town about 700 plus miles away from Moscow in the foothills of the Ural Mountains, a town that had previously been closed to all foreigners except German prisoners of war after World War II who helped build part of the city. But for Americans, no, Americans had never been there. I was part of a team of 30 Americans who lived there permanently. I worked there for 2 years. It was a fascinating job. I learned a lot about arms control. And I think the most important aspect was I learned about on-site inspection. It's something that hadn't been done before this treaty. And so I was one of the inspectors who helped write the book, literally write the book for on-site inspections. When that job finished, I went back to the Marine Corps. And my return to the Marine Corps coincided with Saddam Hussein's decision to invade Kuwait. And I got caught up in the whole Desert Shield, Desert Storm thing. Did a lot of strategic planning with a special cell that was put together by the Commandant of the Marine Corps. So I got to do some high-level planning, briefing it to the Commandant, et cetera. And then I got sent to General Schwarzkopf's staff, where my missile background meant they gave me the Scud portfolio. So I spent the war working with Air Force and Special Operations units trying to interdict Iraqi Scuds before they were launched against Israel or the Arabian Peninsula. After the war, I tried to get out of the Marine Corps. I joined the Marine Corps. My father was career Air Force. I lived overseas in Turkey and Germany. And I believed in the Soviet threat. Kill a commie for mommy. The only, better dead than red. These were realities of my life. And
have yourself a little drink there. Don't worry. By the way, I've memorized the number to 911 in case
I go down.
Yeah.
But thanks. But the Cold War was over now. The jobs I wanted in the Marine Corps no longer existed. There was something called the U.S. Military Liaison Mission that worked outside of Berlin, and they their job was to spy on the Soviet group of forces in Germany. They no longer existed. Another great job would have been as a defense attaché at the Moscow embassy. Then you get to run around and take covert photographs of whatever the Soviets don't want you to take covert photographs of. That job no longer exists. So I left the Marine Corps thinking I'd go into civilian life, but as Al Pacino's character said in Godfather, every time I try to get out, they keep dragging me back in. And next thing I know, the phone rings and I end up going to the United Nations. I was brought in because of my arms control experience. That I wrote the book on-site inspection, that I served in the Gulf War. I knew something about Scud missiles, and I was an intelligence officer. I was brought in to create an intelligence capability within the United Nations to help track down Iraq's weapons of mass destruction programs, which at that point in time, they were lying about and hiding from us. And I spent 7 years rewriting the on-site inspection book to include intrusive on-site inspections, a new category, and developing expertise of Iraqi WMD, also global intelligence capabilities. Ended up resigning in August 1998, protesting what I deemed to be U.S. interference in the work of the inspectors. And since that time, I think you could say that I've been a vocal critic of what I deem to be bad policy on the part of the United States. I'm a loyal American, put my life on the line for my country. I love my country. But I also believe that if you believe in America and you believe in the promise of America, you have a duty and obligation as a citizen to hold those whom you elect to higher office accountable for what they do in your name. And given my background, I feel like I'm in a position to be critical of arms control policy, of international security policy, Middle East policy, Russia policy. And that's where we find ourselves today, with this war in Ukraine. I'm extraordinarily critical of the U.S. posture in this conflict.
Well, with a killer resume like that, I shouldn't be surprised that you left out one of your greatest achievements, which is you are by far the funniest weapons inspector on Twitter.
No, that might just be a byproduct of sheer incompetence than anything else.
Well, at Real Scott Ritter is your Twitter handle, and I actually mean that you are very funny, but you just garnish. You're talking about life and death matters, so you just garnish your tweets with humor here and there. as is appropriate. But you've been building up a huge following, and you're very much a no frills, low tech, humble way. And I've noticed lately you're getting an absolutely overwhelming response. People just thanking you and so appreciative of how hard you're working. You're cranking out these articles for numerous publications. You're doing interviews lasting 1-2 hours often. And I'm wondering something that I bet a lot of other people are wondering too, is how do you have time to do it all? And because in other words, it takes, when you write an article, you have to spend time thinking about it before you even write it, you know?
And before all this happened, before the world exploded in Ukraine, I mean, right now I pretty much make a living writing. I write books. I wish they'd sell better, then I wouldn't have to write so many articles. But I write articles, and you get paid per article. I mean, that's just the reality of it. So the more you put out, the better. But I can't just crank out, I watch what I say, garbage. If I'm going to put my name on it, and I'm attaching what I think is a pretty cool resume that's based upon, you know, credibility derived from integrity and service. And if I'm going to say that I was an experienced intelligence officer, that means that when I put something down on paper, it's got to stand that test. It's got to stand up to that resume, which means there's a lot of research that goes into it. Not just the research, but before I write an article, I say, what do I want to write about and why do I want to write about it? I mean,
it's a very special kind of research because we're talking about a situation that's very fluid in Ukraine. And you seem to be getting some really good information. So that's another thing that I think people are wondering about is who are your sources? And give us a typical day in the life and how you, I'm not asking for names, but just the type of people that you're in contact with. What's a typical day in the life and how are you getting this information?
Well, you're going to probably be very disappointed because if you notice, I'm not quoting people in my articles. Mm-hmm. What I specialize at is what is called connecting the dots. That is to take a plethora of open source data, then bring it together. And then I use my experience to sort out the wheat from the chaff. And there's very few kernels of wheat out there. I look at a lot of what's put out on, in the news, and I just discard it right off the bat because it doesn't meet the smell test. It stinks. The mainstream media is echoing garbage. It's all garbage. It's fact-free fiction. And I don't deal with fact-free fiction. I have to bring it back and say, what makes sense? What pieces of data can I actually say, I'm willing to put my reputation on this? It's not that I call up, President so-and-so and say, hey, do you know anything about this? No, I don't have time to do that. B, I don't want to do that because I don't really care what they think. It's what I think. I look at the data. That's what an intelligence officer does. Intelligence officers don't sit around picking up the phone. They're not journalists. I'm not a journalist. I'm an intelligence officer. My job is to evaluate data, and I do that. And then my job is to, determine whether the data has credibility or not. And I discard the stuff that doesn't. I focus on the stuff that does. And then I try to see if there's enough of it there to make a story that is compelling to a reader. Because I just don't write because I want to write. I try to write an article that somebody can read it and say, I learned something from this.
Right. Is there any outlet or any particular person that you could recommend if somebody wants good information that you think has a good reputation that we should know about?
I'm loath to do that only because I'd have to really think long and hard about it, which means I'd have to go back and review everything they wrote and make sure that there's consistency and accuracy, content and quality. I'm sure you and I have had this conversation before. Right now, I don't want people listening to me right now saying, because Scott Ritter said X, therefore is dogma, we go. No. I actually would prefer if people were watching this skeptically, thinking that everything Ritter says is a lie. He's a tool of the American establishment that is out here to fool Jeff Norman and U.S. Tour of Duty by promulgating garbage. And I want you to write down everything I say and then go investigate it. Do your own research. And if I'm right, you know, then you say, okay, Ritter was right on this one. Trust but verify is a reality.
Yeah.
You can trust what I'm saying if you want to, but verify it before you jump on it. And that's why I don't want to say, you know, go to this person because they're, no, go to yourself. Go to yourself and do the research yourself. Formulate your own opinion so that not only do you have an opinion, but you can defend the opinion. Be your own expert. And you can do this. It's hard work, but you can do it.
Especially
right now, if for instance, this interview that we're doing, I'm sure we're going to get some hard data points put out. I'm going to commit to some hard data points. All right. I've made the job easy now for your research. You don't have to decide, you know, which hard data point you're going to just write down what I said and prove me wrong. Try to. I challenge everybody. Prove me wrong.
Right.
You're going to have a hard time doing that because I've done my own research. But
right. It's not easy, though. I'll give you an example. But before I do, let me ask, do you happen to be familiar with Patrick Lancaster?
I've been watching him, yeah.
Okay. So our producer, Tori, has a knack for finding great information out there that maybe we're not otherwise aware of. So he's a Navy veteran who's on the ground in Ukraine.
Yep.
So let me just show you a little something. And I want to, this is an example of how what you're giving good advice about how we shouldn't believe anything necessarily, but it's difficult. Here's Patrick, a report from Patrick Lancaster talking to elderly or semi-elderly locals in Ukraine, and they're, well, let's just watch it.
Как мы только пережили это все?
Они всем говорили, собирайтесь и уходите. Все.
Как это?
А куда уходить?
В квартиру уходить будут.
Вот людей, мы остались, и они тут все бомбили.
У людей на поселках выгоняли с домов и занимали помещения под свои орудия, под свои минометы.
Вы не говорите, это не...
So we can talk over it because they're not speaking in English, but that's just the point. It looks like the Ukrainians are blaming Ukrainians for what happened, and we see a translation there. I assume it's the truth, but not only do we not know what they're saying, we don't even know what language it is. I mean, is it Ukrainian? Is it Russian? And here's a translation coming across the screen there. So it's one thing to be diligent enough to find something like this, but how do you even verify this? We can't instantly decide to learn the language. You know what I mean?
No, you're right. I mean, this is, first of all, it's invaluable journalism that he's doing.
Yeah.
But again, we're viewing it from long distance.
Right.
We don't know if this was a setup. We don't know if his Russian handler said, hey, we're going to have some people coming by here. You go ahead and talk to them. Now, I've watched enough of his broadcast. He proclaims to be an independent journalist who does his own reporting. And I hope that's true. And I hope that what we just saw there was as fresh as it looked. But
yeah.
You don't know.
Yeah.
We do know, for instance, on the Ukrainian side, they have called the 72nd Information and Public Operations, or it's basically a propaganda unit of the Ukrainian Armed Forces that works together with the intelligence services, and trained and equipped and guided by the CIA for the sole purpose of putting out propaganda that is designed to hurt Russia. And they're the ones that have been putting out a lot of the things that we've seen, the ghost of Kiev, the 13, suicidal soldiers on the Snake Island that gave the finger to the boat, you know, things that didn't happen.
What amused me about that was the first thing that struck me is that they were quoted as saying, you know, like, fuck off. And so if anything like that happened at all, my assumption is there's probably 50 different ways to translate it. But of course, they picked the most provocative way to do it. And then on top of that, they censored. They did the F asterisk, asterisk, asterisk thing.
Right.
But what they're doing is they're making up the quote And then they're censoring themselves, which is like absurdity on top of absurdity.
Well, apparently the recording was genuine because the, again, you don't know because it could be all. But the one of the survivors, the guy who Ukrainians claim was the voice on the quote, was brought into a senior officer's room and he was given a medal for his bravery and telling the Russians to stick it in their ear. But the point you're bringing up is a valuable one. It wasn't being packaged for Ukrainian consumption. That story was solely packaged for consumption by the West.
Yeah,
it was built to be consumed by a Western audience. Believe me, in Ukraine, they're using their version of the F word freely. But here, because we have censorship, they had to ... boom, so they could be freely played on the media. They had packaged it to be delivered to the media. And this is the thing that you need to understand. Ukrainians are packaging information to be delivered to the Western media so they can be immediately played on major broadcast networks. Patrick Lancaster's stuff is not packaged that way.
He has unedited footage and it goes on and on for a period of time.
It'd be very difficult to get that on, even if a mainstream media outlet was so inclined. It would be very difficult to get that on, just from a production value standpoint. So,
But you mentioned propaganda. I'm curious how you compare the propaganda tactics being used nowadays to, let's say, back in the Iraq War days, when I don't know, a lot of people who are just discovering may not know this, but Scott was a paid commentator, I think, on two different networks. Is that correct?
I was paid by Fox. Mm-hmm. I was accredited to BBC. No, I was paid by NBC. I started off with NBC, then I was accredited to BBC, but didn't get in a paycheck. Those darn Brits. And then Fox paid me. Yeah.
Right. So in those, and then they you're essentially blacklisted because they didn't like the truth.
They didn't like what I was saying. Yeah.
Yeah. Right. So how does that era compare to the current era in your mind, just in general, in terms of censorship and propaganda? Is it kind of the same thing with somewhat different tactics? Is it getting worse, or because of the internet, are we sort of competing with them now more because of the internet?
Well, I mean, here we'll make some news today. Okay, I'll give you some news that maybe people aren't aware of. I was involved in two instances of what we'll call black propaganda while I was a weapons inspector. And what I mean by that is, in 1997, we being the inspectors, were on our back foot. I had attempted to inspect a security facility in a presidential site in Baghdad on October 1st of 1997, and we were turned away by the Iraqis, who immediately, said wonderful things about me and everything. But then they got support from the Russians and the French, and we found ourselves having to convene an emergency session of the Special Commission. We were the United Nations Special Commission, but we were separate from the Special Commission. We were the inspectors. The Special Commission was a board of a dozen or so international experts that met once a year, and they gave all the responsibility of running the inspections to the executive chairman of the Special Commission. But now the Russians and the Chinese, because this is the United Nations, said we want the Special Commission to meet and decide if Ritter is, a spy, evil, doing the job, freelance, and whatever. But it was very personal. They were coming after me hard. And they're coming after the inspectors hard as well. They're trying to shut the whole thing down and say they were illegitimate. And so we had this meeting of the Special Commission, and it was just one giant exercise in propaganda. I mean, both sides. I mean, you'd see that the meeting would occur, and then all of a sudden, the American representative would disappear before anything. He'd run off and get his New York Times person, and he'd spin the meeting with the American spin. And there was definitely an American spin. Then the Russian would run off and get his person, he'd spin it, and you'd have competing narratives, none of which were the truth. But the bottom line is, we inspectors were hurting. We felt we weren't getting our message out. So, ironically enough, the deputy executive chairman, a guy named Charles Dolfer, reached out to CNN. And we got a senior CNN producer and a film crew to come in. And I was instructed to work with them to release U2 imagery of select sites in Baghdad, and that would help them understand what we were trying to accomplish. And then they made me and other inspectors available for interviews. And they put together a very, very well done program that aired in March of 1998. But, you know, and it, you know, it was aired as a CNN, you know, documentary kind of thing. But the producers were the inspectors. We wrote the damn thing. We were shaping public opinion. Now, I call it black propaganda because we didn't admit that we were the ones doing this. We acted as if we were just being interviewed. But we were the inspectors seeking to use the media to create propaganda that would counter the propaganda coming from Iraq, France, and Russia. Nothing evil about it, but it shows you that what you're seeing on the air, generally speaking, isn't pure. It's somebody trying to get their message across through the media, and the media willfully doing this. Because if CNN was a genuine journalistic outlet, they wouldn't have run a one-sided show like that. They would have gone to the Russians, to the French, to the Iraqis, and tried to get their perspective. They didn't. They were telling from. And then I worked with the British. We at the same time period, the British MI6. They have a department. In their service called Information Operations. And they came to me. We were receiving a lot, we being the UN, were receiving a lot of intelligence from a lot of sources. And if it was what we call actionable intelligence, meaning hard data that we could inspect on, we'd use it. But if not, it just went to our files. And the British said, do you have stuff in your files that you can't use, but is sexy enough that we can package it and release it to the media so that we create this notion of Iraq is cheating? And I went, yeah, I got a whole bunch of that. I got permission from Richard Butler, who was the executive chairman. And I worked with MI6 for a period of months, a program called Mass Appeal. And I'd give them these files and then we'd shape it. And then MI6 would use their connections in British media and global media to release what everybody knew was not an accurate piece of intelligence, but packaged as if it were, so it would run in newspapers to try and sway the public opinion. Again, we did this to counter what the Iraqis, French, and Russians were doing to us. But that's two pieces of my experience in
right.
What I call
black propaganda. So then would it be safe to say that it's kind of always been this way, but maybe just some of the tactics are changing? Like, for example, the U.S. State Department is sending tweets out in Russian language, you know, trying to win over the hearts and minds of the Russian people, which...
Yeah, we have different technology today. Yeah. Different technology. There wasn't any Twitter back then. There wasn't... I don't think there was even Facebook. There was nothing. The only thing you had were newspapers and TV. Today, the State Department can get much more personal. You know, the State Department took up this black propaganda thing to fight ISIS under Barack Obama's regime. We were losing. We, being the United States, were losing the propaganda war to ISIS on social media. They were being very effective in getting their message out, recruiting, etc. So the State Department created a team whose sole job was to counter the ISIS. Now that team has expanded, and the CIA is deeply involved. And as I said, the CIA has been working with the Ukrainians directly. But they train them, they recruit to build the Ukrainian propaganda machine. The Ukrainians have one of the most effective propaganda machines out there. I mean, you can say anything you want about them. You can hate their ideology, which I do, but they're winning the information war. There's no one out there who can say that the Russians are winning the war, but the information war is being run by Ukraine, hands down. And, you know, I'm sure we'll talk about this Bucha incident, but it is 100% BS propaganda. But Ukraine has somehow convinced the world, despite everything that the evidence shows, that the Russians did this. They're war criminals. Putin, you have the President of the United States talking about Putin going to The Hague. I mean, talk about committing suicide. I dare you to try that, Biden, but I don't want you to, because the world will end. He's the damn president of Russia. He can kick your ass anytime he wants to. And you're talking about sending him to The Hague? Are you high? I mean, this is kind of insanity that goes on. They're believing their own propaganda. And to show you how stupid the president is, the same time he gives that speech, the Pentagon says, yeah, we got nothing to back up what the Ukrainians say. We're not saying they're wrong, but we got nothing that proves them right.
All right, well, let's take a look at some footage from... Now, you just said Bucha. Is it pronounced Bucha or Buka? I'm not correcting you. I'm asking.
I'm an American. I call it Bucha. Some people call it Buka. We'll see. I've heard others.
Is it Kiev or Kiev?
Well, I'm potato an old school Soviet guy. It's Kiev. If you're a Ukrainian, it's Kiev. And if you're CNN announcer, it's Kiev.
However you pronounce it, let's take a look at some footage and then... And then also Zelensky reacting to it, and then President Biden reacting to it.
Кадри не з кіно, це кіно, це реальність. Жахлива реальність.
Pay attention to that box. I'll bring that back up. That box too, the green box with the star on it.
Say that. What's that?
Руками. I just see the hands tied.
Yeah.
And then the green boxes with the stars on them, the white stars.
Mm-hmm. What does that mean?
I'll tell you once the film's done.
We're having a slow internet connection because this is going slower than it's supposed to.
Скажу вам, что чем дольше будет Российская Федерация затягивать процесс встречи, тем хуже для них, и в принципе для этой ситуации, для этой войны. Потому что с каждым днем, когда заходят наши войска и деоккупируют те или иные территории, вы видите, что происходит. Очень сложно разговаривать, когда ты видишь то, что они тут натворили.
You may remember I got criticized for calling Putin a war criminal. Well, the truth of the matter, you saw what happened to Vuka. This warrants him, he is a war criminal. But we have to gather the information. We have to continue to provide Ukraine with the weapons they need to continue the fight. And we have to gather all the detail so this can be have a war crime trial. This guy is brutal. And what's happening in Vuka is outrageous. And everyone's seen it.
So it's presented as fact, pretty much, that Russia is committing war crimes. So what's your reaction to that?
Well, first of all, the dozen or so bodies that we saw on that video, the first thing you'll know is that the vast majority of them are carrying the dry rations that the Russians give out to people for humanitarian reasons. Those green boxes with the white star on it, and it says Voyantorg military store. These are dry rations that the Russians hand out to hungry people. The other thing you'll notice is that many of them had white armbands on, which is the signal that you are with the Russian side, and that if you're, for instance, a civilian trying to make your way to the Russian side, or you have gone over to the Russians, you wear this. The other one is that the others had their white armbands taken off, and they were bound. Their hands were bound behind their backs. So what we're talking about here is the evidence that presents itself is we're talking about a pro-Russian collection of people who had received assistance from the Russians, people who identified with the Russians and were most likely seeking to make their way to the Russians. And so it's counterintuitive that the Russians are shooting them down, especially when we have evidence that from the same time period, videotape that shows the Ukrainian National Police, which isn't the Ukrainian National Police, by the way, they've been taken over by the Azov Nazis. So these are disgusting Nazi pigs coming in, and you hear the voice saying, hey, they don't have the blue mark on. Can I shoot them? And the other guy says, beep, yes, the beep being the F word. Yes, shoot them. And they do. And you hear people screaming for mercy. Please don't. Pow, pow. They're dead. Oh, CNN will never play that video. Nor will they play the videotape of a senior person in Ukrainian leader, a female, who went on social media telling the citizens of Bucha on or about 1st of April that the national police are going to be carrying out a cleansing operation, and don't interfere with it. And that by cleansing, now we go to the national police's own statement that talks about we're going in and we're liquidating the collaborators, and they use another term that implies people who were working with Russians. Then they say we're going to give them a haircut, and that's World War II Banderist, Bander being Stefan Bandera, his followers, the Nazis. For we're going to kill them, we're going to clip them. All this data is there. We have physical evidence of dead bodies. Why don't people do autopsies? Autopsies will give you time of death, causation of death, and you can determine whether or not the bodies were moved there or were there originally. The New York Times has come out with this ridiculous, ridiculous video comparison that says that these people died on March 19th. Well, I've seen dead bodies that have been in the field for 2 weeks. They don't look like this. They're swollen. They're green. They stink. They've burst open. Everything's coming out of them. And it wasn't that cold to preserve their bodies. So these bodies haven't been laying there since March 19th. Not only that, some people have done the forensic research on this. The image was taken April 1st, as the Russians said. The Russians are telling the truth here, 100%. The New York Times either lied about the date or got it wrong. But the people went back to the same satellite company that produced those videos, did the analysis, the forensics on it, and they came out and said the New York Times is showing a 1 April image that was actually claiming it was March 19th. And they, it's just garbage. Everything about this story is garbage. Every piece of data is there. I could, right now, with the data available, run a successful war crimes prosecution against every Ukrainian I can link to this crime, because not only do I have the actual crime, a dead body, I can show that it was willful. It wasn't an accident. No, people die in war. Tragedy, civilians die. And sometimes a lot of civilians die. And that's just a byproduct of war. Every dead civilian does not constitute a crime. In fact, it's the vast majority of dead civilians are just a collateral consequence of combat. Now, if you're going to call what happened here a crime, and I believe it is, did the people who shot them, was it willful or an accident? I mean, I have to tell you, if you got 12 people coming at you and you're a scared Russian soldier, and you think one of them might have a javelin because they've been shooting javelin missiles, killing your buddies, you might fire first. That's not a war crime. That's just what war is. But if you're 12 people trying to run away from a cleansing operation being run by the national police, who are out to give you a haircut, and the national police gun you down, that's a crime. And then you say, well, was it their intent to do this? We have the videotape of the lady saying, we're doing a cleansing operation. We have the video of the guys actually killing people. You can convict all of them right now. And yet they're talking about convicting Russians who had nothing to do with this. We know the Russians had nothing to do with this. And yet they're holding Security Council meetings, allowing the president of Ukraine, who is a war criminal. Literally, I can convict him right now for what he's done in perpetrating the mythology of Bucha. He knows it's a lie.
That's what I wanted to ask you, because I don't know if you were what you were referring to exactly, but right before I played the clip, you said something about how the propagandists are believing their own propaganda, which is not what you just said now. So do you have any, like, let's look at the American side, for example. Does somebody like Biden realize what he's saying or not?
Let me put it this way. The CIA is married to the Ukrainian propagandists. They're running the show. They're building these clips. They're driving the narrative. So if the CIA is doing that and the president is consuming it, either the CIA has briefed the president and the president knows that he's propagating a lie, which makes him criminally culpable, by the way. Find a lawyer that tells me I'm wrong. I dare you. They won't. But more likely, the CIA isn't briefing the president and he's consuming it and running off at the mouth. This is why the Pentagon, as soon as the president spoke, the Pentagon went out and went, we don't have any evidence to corroborate what's going on. We're not denying it. We have no evidence.
It didn't happen.
So you just wrote a two-part article for Consortium News on war crimes. So let's get into that. According to the UN Charter, I think it's Article 51, it kind of implies that military action is justified only in self-defense. But I guess it's not quite that simple.
Well, it's individual or collective self-defense. These are two important terms. Individual self-defense is talking about an individual member of the United Nations community. Collective self-defense gets more complicated because you would think it would mean it would be a collective of UN members, but actually collective self-defense can include things such as NATO, which is not a member state, has no status under the UN Charter, but if it's linked with a NATO member or NATO members, it becomes part of this collective. And there's a term that they use about a security grouping, a security arrangement. There's specific legal terminology that's skipping my mind right now. But the other thing is, it says an attack, but is an attack, you have to actually wait for the guy to punch you in the face? Or if the guy is sitting there, he's telling you he's going to punch you in his face, and he's wrapping up his fist, and he's getting ready to punch, and he pulls his fist back, do you have to wait, or can you just pop him in the throat, drop him down, stomp his face, and end the fight? You know, preemption. And there's people who interpret Article 51 very strictly. And they say, no, you have to wait for the attack. But even the international community doesn't recognize that. They recognize the right of preemption if an attack is going to be imminent. And there are no other options. And what Russia has done here under Article 51, because they've claimed an Article 51 justification, and their collective self-defense, because people say, well, Ukraine didn't attack Russia. Correct. Ukraine was actually attacking Ukraine. It was sort of a civil conflict with Donbass, the Donetsk and Lugansk having tried to declare their independence, but Russia up until recently didn't recognize it. And so nobody recognized them as independent. And so it was very much an internal struggle. But what Russia did is recognize the independent status of these two things. And people say, well, they're not UN members, so they don't have any rights under the UN. Russia does. And by creating a collective defense arrangement between Russia and the newly independent entities of Lugansk and Donetsk, Russia can now claim collective security. Now, you will say, yeah, but still, that can only apply to the Donbass. I mean, if Russia is going to come to assist them, it can only be to deal with the attack that's ongoing. Wait a minute. No one can tell you that there wasn't an imminent threat to these two entities. They were being bombarded on a daily basis by the Ukrainians for 8 years, 14,000 people dead. No one's making this up. But you say, well, how do you go from that to invading all of Ukraine? Well, if the Ukrainians have, for instance, massed 60 to 120,000 of their finest troops in the Donbass region and are preparing to launch a preemptive attack of their own into Lugansk and Donetsk to recapture it, Russia says we have a right now to expand the defense of these nations to take care of this threat, to preemptively deal with this threat. And because once we engage with them, we'll be vulnerable to what the rest of Ukraine has out here, up by Kiev, out west, down south in Odessa. If we do nothing about them, they'll reinforce, they'll dictate the pace of the battle. We could be defeated. So to guarantee victory, we must expand the operation to shape the battlefield, run a diversion against Kiev to freeze them in place, divert resources down to Odessa, back up to Kiev, everywhere but the east. And that's what Russia did. And you know what? They have no legal fault with their argument. There are a lot of people will scream bloody murder, but you can't. You want to know why you can't? Because Russia simply modeled their legal argument based upon what NATO used to justify their attack against Serbia in 1999.
Hasn't the U.S. also relied on this doctrine of preemption? Didn't the U.S. invent it, actually?
Well, no, the doctrine of preemption has been around for some time now. I mean, one of the foundations of the legal concept. There's a, you know, a political guy, Gracius, back 15th, 16th century. But the modern version of it comes from what's called the Caroline Affair, which I think took place in 1837 or something like that. It's a U.S. ship, the Caroline, that was attacked by the British. No war existed, no warning. They just attacked it because the British said the Caroline was getting ready to support Canadian rebels. And so we had to preempt. And the world recognized the legitimacy of the British action because the doctrine of preemption was, we don't have to wait for them to do this. If we know they're doing it and it's imminent and we have no other option, we take them out. And the principle of the Caroline, dogma or whatever you want to call it, the precedent, has survived through time. It's still quoted today when people talk about the legality of the doctrine of preemption. They all go back to the Caroline incident. So it's been around.
How does the Cuban Missile Crisis and the logic used there apply or compare to the logic used here?
We would have been authorized under Article 51 to launch a preemptive attack against the Soviets. But John Kennedy said, that's Pearl Harbor, man. We ain't doing it. Even if we can legally come up with a excuse. Because remember, Pearl Harbor, the Japanese attacked when there wasn't a UN charter. There was no Article 51. I think the Japanese could have put together an Article 51 claim, based on what the U.S. was doing with oil and the embargoes and the positioning of forces in the Philippines, etc. Japan might have been, it might not have succeeded because of the issue of imminent threat. But, Kennedy said, we're not going to replicate Pearl Harbor. So he had a moral obligation. So even if you have a legal right to do something, sometimes there's a moral authority that takes precedent. And that's what Kennedy believed. He said, we're not going to have a new Pearl Harbor, not while I'm president. Unfortunately for the world, George W. Bush didn't feel that way. And he used the argument of imminent threat and need for preemptive attack to justify the invasion. Right. The problem with Bush, as was the problem with NATO, because NATO used hyped up information about genocide being perpetrated against the Albanian population in Kosovo to justify its attack, and that was imminent. Turned out every single incident that they talked about being genocide was actually the CIA working with the Kosovo Liberation Army to create the conditions for a quote unquote massacre. To shape the information battlefield. It's part of black propaganda being used to justify a war. And then, Bush was using the whole WMD mythology, weapons of mass destruction. And, they went to war on that. Then they found out that what they were saying was, that justified the imminent, the definition, the need for imminent threat was fabrication. And the U.S. knew it was fabrication. So the U.S. claim goes out the window. The U.S. is a war criminal, literally. I mean, I laughed when the lady who's being considered for the Supreme Court, Jackson, I think her last name is. She was asked, do you think that Bush is a war criminal? Well, yes, it's not what I think. He is a war criminal. Everybody acknowledges it. The U.S. violated international law when it invaded Iraq in 2003. George W. Bush is a war criminal. Dick Cheney is a war criminal. Every American that participated in that, in the senior level, is a war criminal. They should be brought to The Hague and tried and, spend the rest of their life in a tiny cell. But it'll never happen. But yes, he's a war criminal. You know who's not a war criminal? Vladimir Putin's not a war criminal.
You're talking about what justifies going to war.
Right.
Now, there's a different way to analyze individual acts that occur once the war is underway. So let's take a look at some of the things that have been going on. Here's a video that went viral, and I'm sure you've seen it. I'd like to get your take on it. No, that's the wrong one. Sorry.
That's the one we just looked at.
This is when soldiers are apparently being shot in the leg. And it looks to me like maybe looks like torture. Looks like they're being forced to bleed out and die, actually. but maybe they're trying to get information out of this, is what I'm not quite sure about, but maybe you can explain who this is and why this is happening.
Well, the whole video starts with actually a vehicle being door opened up and men coming out of the van and
that's coming.
Okay, that's coming. Okay,
yeah. But go on, we can talk over it because we're not there.
Oh, then they get shot. They just get kneecapped.
Right,
shot in the legs.
Right, and so my assumption is that's what happened to these people before we see them shoot the others in the leg. It looks like
you're allowed to make that assumption. The other thing that's happened is look at the leg here. That is a broken leg. That is a broken bone. He's not being provided with immediate medical care. This is a war crime happening right in front of you. You are obligated as a military force when somebody is rendered, so that they can't. I think here we come. Yep, he went down. Yep, they went down.
Right, this is really difficult to watch, but I mean, it's reality. Yep. So we should.
Hey, this is a crime happening right before. This is an undisputed crime. Not just the shooting of them, but the fact that you have a wounded person who's not receiving immediate medical attention. It's a war crime. If I'm a Marine, I'm in combat. I've blown away somebody and they're alive, but I'm still receiving fire. I may not be able to render assistance to that person. But once the battle is over and there's no more threat, I must immediately attend that person as I would any other Marine. Mm-hmm. I have an obligation under the Geneva Convention to provide medical assistance to that person. And the Ukrainians clearly aren't. They're allowing the people to bleed out. They're mocking them. They're making fun of them. It's a war crime, and it's there. Right. We know where this happened. We know when it happened, and we even know who did it. And yet there's not a single indictment coming out of the International Criminal Court about this because the West, I mean, even CNN had to, pathetic little CNN had to say this tape makes us uncomfortable, but we haven't verified that this is what happened. Well, there it is, man. It's verified.
I mean, is this just out and out sadism, or is there, not that it would justify it, but are they trying to get information out of them, or it's just
No. This is just punishment. It appears that they killed a bunch of those people too, because later on there's some videos that showed the bodies being burned. But then you have evidence that the Russian prisoners of war they're being returned have had their fingers cut off. Anecdotal evidence that they have in fact been castrated, which now leads us to a videotape, on air, admission by the head medical guy in the Ukrainian military saying, we need to castrate all the Russians and send them back home without any, without their manhood. This is happening. This is happening. The Ukrainians are a criminal enterprise because this stuff is happening and the leadership's doing nothing about it. Zelensky is denying it, or he claims he's going to do an investigation, but has he arrested these people? Is he charged them? Has he punished them? No, they're still out there fighting. And the Ukrainians are excusing all of this. I mean, you had a senior advisor to the president say, the laws of war don't apply to us because we're defending our homeland. Oh, guess what, dude? They apply to you and they're going to apply to you. I mean, pro tip to Ukraine. You're going to lose this war and you're all going to be held accountable. Maybe not by the International Criminal Court. That would be a gift. You're going to be held accountable by Russian justice. You're going to be arrested. You're going to be put on trial. You're going to be found guilty because you are guilty. And then you're going to be punished. And I'll leave it up to Russia. But there's some talk that Putin may bring back the death penalty because some of these people need to hang by the neck until dead.
Well, to paraphrase Michael Herr, sometimes making an accusation of a war crime is a little bit like citing a driver for speeding at the Indy 500. But I think what you're saying is, in this case, it is pretty clear cut.
Look, I have a hard time calling things that people, like, give you an example. During the Gulf War, we bombed we being the United States, bombed a what turned out to be an air raid shelter. There's 400 plus Iraqi civilians in there who died horribly. Everybody's saying that's a war crime. That's a war crime. That's a war crime. No, it's not. We thought it was a command and control center. We had intelligence that said there was presidential level communications coming out at a time when we were desperate to stop Scuds being launched, and we believe that the orders to launch Scuds came from the president. So we believe that if we wanted to stop Scuds from being fired, maybe we should take out this command and control center. So we dropped two bombs on it. First one to penetrate through the concrete, second one to go down there and blow up what we believed was a communication center down below. The key to a war crime is intent. Intent. Have you willingly done this? Have you knowingly done this to commit the crime? If you can articulate a sound, reasonable reason for doing what you did, intelligence-based, that there was military necessity and that proportionally what you were going to get out of the conflict, matched the military gain you get, wouldn't be offset by the human loss, then well, you're putting up there, it's not a war crime. So the fact of the matter is,
you just mentioned
a lot of things are called war crimes that aren't.
In your article, you mentioned four factors that go into the calculation: military necessity, humanity, proportionality, and distinction, meaning distinguishing between civilians and military personnel. Can you explain a little bit about how those four factors work in combination with each other?
Well, the first one was military necessity, that there has to be a legitimate military reason for doing this. You can't just blow up a building because you want to blow up a building. And so if I'm running a military operation, a military campaign, am I going to apply firepower on it? The military necessity in taking out a machine gun post is obvious. The military necessity in taking out a moving tank is obvious. The military necessity in taking out a house that's occupied by an enemy command element is obvious. Same thing with taking out a train that could be moving troops, taking out fuel dumps. I mean, if whatever you want to take out, I could take out a damn church, which is specified as a protected area, if there's a sniper in there. Okay, that's military necessity. There has to be a legitimate military reason for doing this. And then there's the concept of humanity. Can't try to torture you in the process of killing. This is a tough one, because, napalm sticks like glue, sticks to women and children too. I mean, we used to sing that all the time, because it's true. It's if you're going to use napalm, you drop napalm for a specific reason, because it's going to burn everything out there. But some people would say that, and this is why we stopped using it, because the humanity factor comes in. Is that really what we want to be doing? Something that's indiscriminate in its use of lethal force. So you have to consider the humanity aspect of what you're doing. The third one was
proportionality.
Proportionality again. That one is, if I've got an enemy in a bunker and in a party, I'll give you a different one for proportionality. We'll use the example that's in like Mariupol. You have an apartment complex, and the enemy is operating in one corner of it with a machine gun nest. I have the right to fire a tank round through that window and take out that machine gun nest, even if the room is fully occupied with 20 civilians. It's just a bad day to be a civilian in that room. And the onus isn't on me. The onus is on the machine gun nest, who has allowed a military position to be put in place without evacuating the civilians. They have an obligation under the laws of war to do that. And if they don't, then they're using the civilians as a human shield. But now if I have that machine gun nest and I go, I'm just going to put three thermobaric rounds into the basement of this building and collapse the whole building, that's not proportional. That's a military response that's out of proportion. Now, if that whole building is occupied, then I can drop the whole building, even if there's civilians in there, because, like I said, it's a bad day to be a civilian in war. If you're having to be killed.
That's one of the trickiest things for me to wrap my head around, because I get what you're saying, that there's an obligation to remove the civilians if there's military personnel or military equipment in the area. But on the other hand, what if it's not possible? What if some of the civilians don't want to go or aren't able to, have no place to go. It seems like it's a really gray area and hard to.
No, it's actually not a gray area. You know how you deal with it?
How?
You raise a white flag, not of surrender, but of parley. Mm-hmm. Then you go out to your enemy and you say, I got civilians in this building and I want to get rid of them. I want to get them out of here. And the person you're talking to has to, under the law of war, must. He can't say, no way. He has to say, yes, we will provide them safe passage. And you have a ceasefire, and the safe passage is provided. And then when you say all the civilians are gone, you say, okay, we're back to war. And now you fight the war. That's what has to happen with a trained, professional military force. And you know who's trained and professional? The Russians. You know what they've offered every single fight? Safe passage. Safe passage. It's the Ukrainians that say no, because they're using the humans as a human shield. Zelensky is a war criminal. Literally. He knowingly permits his armed forces to use Ukrainian civilians as a human shield. That is a war crime. There's no if and or but about it. And in every single fight, the Russians have said, we want to get them out. We're offering safe passage to the civilians. We are offering a ceasefire. Repeated day after day after day, they've offered this, and they've been rejected by the Ukrainian government from day one.
Yet it's Putin who is demonized by the U.S. and NATO and the media, and it's Zelensky who is propped up as being, you know, as pure as the driven snow. So the U.S., another one of your articles was about regime change, and that's the policy of the U.S. government. To understand what's going on right this minute a little bit better, maybe we should go back a couple of weeks when Biden was in Poland and he had his gaffe when he kind of let the cat out of the bag about regime change. Let's take a look at that.
Now back in Washington, the White House is clarifying an off-the-cuff remark U.S. President Joe Biden made during a speech in Poland, seeming to suggest it was time for the Russians to force President Vladimir Putin out.
For God's sake, this man cannot remain power.
The comment seemed to be a direct call for regime change in Russia. White House officials were quick to clear up any confusion.
We do not have a strategy of regime change in Russia or anywhere else for that matter. It's up to the people of the country in question. It's up to the Russian people.
Well, that's a clever answer by Blinken. We don't have a strategy of regime change, either in Russia or anywhere else. It's up to the people of Russia. Well, no kidding, Tony. What if you're working covertly to fund opposition groups to create the conditions to overthrow Putin? Not through democracy, because democracy is about the domestic imperative of a sovereign nation to pick its own leaders, not to have outside parties come in and pick them for you. That's called regime change. What if you're, while you're doing this, trying to create a narrative that paints Russia in a bad light? What if you're trying to apply economic sanctions for the sole purpose of creating harmful conditions for the Russian people that encourages them to rise up against their leader? What if you're doing all this in concert? Is that not a policy of regime change? And the answer is yes, it is. And it's been going on for some time now. The United States has had an active policy of regime change targeting Vladimir Putin since Barack Obama first came into office in 2009. What the hell do you think the reset was about? That famous little picture of Lavrov and Hillary Clinton chuckling as he pushes a red button that, you know, claimed to say reset, but really meant overload, because that's what the U.S. policy was an overload. It wasn't a reset. It was regime change designed to empower Dmitry Medvedev, who had taken over as president because Putin had been constitutionally limited to two consecutive terms. Putin had become prime minister. He had to ride out a term of office before he could come back. So Dmitry Medvedev, everybody knew, was a placeholder. What the United States wanted to do under Obama was to make Dmitry Medvedev permanent. And I mean, it got to ridiculous. Joe Biden traveled to Moscow in March of 2011, as you know, because the it was a year before the presidential election would take place in March 2012, and it was a couple months before parliamentary elections would take place in December of 2011. And he said, if I were Putin, I wouldn't run again. I wouldn't try to become president again, because It won't be good for you. It won't be good for Russia. And he was saying this to an audience of political opponents of Vladimir Putin.
Is this what is?
Oh, is that not regime change?
Is this what's sometimes referred to as a color revolution? Is that what the term means?
Well, the Russians have, yeah, it's the popular term for public removal is a color revolution. We've seen a couple of them that are U.S. instigated. Slobodan Milosevic, that was a U.S. instigated color revolution in Serbia that was predicated by the bombing, by the illegal bombing by the United States of Serbia. Muammar Gaddafi was a color revolution instigated by the United States. And now, you know, we've seen it in 2004, I believe, in Ukraine. There was the Orange Revolution. They got rid of Viktor Yanukovych, maybe, or Kuchma. I can't, you know, I'm losing it right now because I'm all over the map in my brain. But anyways, it was a color revolution designed to overthrow the existing government, replace it with something that was more democratic. And this is the key to the United States. We call it democracy. There's nothing democratic about it. It's pro-American. The goal of the United States isn't to create a democracy in Russia. The goal of the United States is to create a weakened executive leader who will once again lie prostrate at the feet of the United States like Boris Yeltsin did in the decade of the 1990s. That's the perfect situation for us. This is where Michael McFaul's of the world come in, you know, because he's the guy that made Yeltsin a reality, and he's the guy that sought to create a new Boris Yeltsin in the form of Dmitry Medvedev, keep a strong Russian leader, Vladimir Putin, out of office. And look, it's a policy regime change, plain and simple. There's literally no debating this point.
Well, when our commander-in-chief returned from his trip, the press grilled him about this a little bit more than they usually do.
I believe what you said, that Putin can't remain in power. Or do you now regret saying that because your government has been trying to walk that back?
Number one, I'm not walking anything back. The fact of the matter is I was expressing the more outrage I felt toward the way Putin is dealing and the actions of this man, just brutality. Half the children in Ukraine. I had just come from being with those families. But I want to make it clear, I wasn't then, nor am I now, articulating a policy change. I was expressing the moral outrage that I feel, and I make no apologies for it. You know, he continues on this course that he's on. He is going to become a pariah worldwide, and who knows what he becomes at home in terms of support. But,
are you concerned this remark might escalate the conflict?
No, I'm not. I'm not at all. It was expressing my outrage. He shouldn't remain in power, just like, you know, bad people shouldn't continue to do bad things. But it doesn't mean we have a fundamental policy to do anything to take Putin down in any way.
What made you add that? Because that wasn't in your prepared remarks, we were told. So what made you add that at the end, Mr. President?
Because I was talking to them, to the Russian people. The last part of the speech was talking to the Russian people, telling them what we thought. I was communicating this to not only the Russian people, but the whole world. This is just stating a simple fact that this kind of behavior is totally unacceptable.
Well, not terribly dissimilar from what you just said, actually, right?
No, I mean, he's playing games here. He's actually, in some ways, telling the truth. Fundamentally, there's been no change in policy. No, there hasn't. Because you are seeking to speak directly to the Russian people to rise up and overthrow Putin. And you're empowering them by, A, creating this narrative of a major Russian defeat when the Russians are winning, designed to demoralize Russian mothers. And this economic sanctions nonsense that is designed to destroy the Russian economy. And, you know, has a single American actually lost any sleep over the fact? Could you imagine if overnight half of America became unemployed, lost their life savings, did not have the ability to feed their family? How would you feel about that? And yet that's what we want to do to the Russian people. Now, thank God for the Russian people. They have a leader like Vladimir Putin who was given 6 months advance notice by the idiot in the White House, Joe Biden, who stared Putin in the eyes, if you remember, in June of 2021, and said, I'm going to sanction you with the hardest sanctions in the world. I'm going to crush you, you evil, soulless murderer. And Putin went, thank you, Mr. President, went back and said, okay, we know what's coming. How do we prepare for this? How do we absorb this damage, and how do we respond in a way that cripples them? And look at what's happening. The idiot in chief, and I hate to say that, but he is. The guy is just stupid. You know, brags. I destroyed the ruble. Their market has collapsed. Ha, ha, ha. Well, no, Mr. President, the ruble's actually rebounded quite well. The Russian market is alive and well and thriving. Thanks to you, because actually your policies allowed Putin to come up with a response that has Russia surviving. Ask Germany how they're doing right now. Ask France how they're doing. Ask the United States how they're going to be doing. We're all going to be suffering, and the Russian people are doing just fine because Putin is smart. Putin had advanced notice. Putin took the appropriate steps. But it doesn't, just because Putin has been successful in deflecting it doesn't, you know, obviate the fact that the United States was seeking to hurt the average Russian citizen, hurt them in a way that we would never find acceptable. Imagine if somebody did something like that.
Let me ask you about that, because I'm wondering, I get what the intent is. What's not so clear is how effective it is. And what I'm thinking about is there's a lot of noise about how, the Russians were interfering with the U.S. election. And then you look at, what is this interference? And so far as I can tell, they bought a few Facebook ads. And to me, it's like, they don't have any influence that's significant here. Yeah. So do we have any more ability to influence things in Russia than they had to influence here? Because if it's anything like what happened here, there's no influence.
Well, let me put it this way. In 1996, we bought a presidential election in Russia. There's there's no debate about it. No Russian scholar will tell you otherwise. They know that the United States went in, poured millions of dollars into supporting Yeltsin's reelection campaign, brought in $1 million worth of advisors, and still had to run a corrupt election to flip the ballots so that Yeltsin won. We did that. We did it. So there, in the history of modern U.S.-Russian relations, there's only one instance of a nation reaching into the other one and flipping an election. That's us in 1996. The Russians didn't flip the election for Trump in 2016. Hillary Clinton flipped the election with some of the brain-dead statements she made, one of the worst campaigns ever run. She took an absolute guaranteed victory, and she turned it into defeat by a guy who, under normal circumstances, shouldn't be elected dog catcher. And yet we made him president, not because he's the most qualified person in the world, but because he's running against somebody who is even less qualified than he was, the president of the United States. The Russians had nothing to do with this. And we're now finding out that, the whole Russiagate thing was actually an excuse by the Obama administration and the Clinton campaign to explain, first it was a desperate attempt to undo her collapsing campaign. It was undue interference by the United States government in a presidential election. Had to have the FBI spying on a presidential candidate. They had the FBI manufacturing false dossiers to undermine a presidential candidate. They had the CIA fabricate or breathe life into a double agent and introduce that intelligence to the White House so that the president's taking actions based upon known disinformation. This is the kind of stuff that people are put up against walls and shot for in some countries. Now, we don't do that in America, but we do arrest people and put them in jail for a long time. And this should be happening to a whole bunch of people, but that's just politics as normal. But my point is, the Russians didn't interfere or influence this election. This election, the people who voted were American citizens whose votes weren't determined by some cheap ad bought by some Russian bot that aired on Facebook. Give me an example of
the internet is full of all kinds of trash,
But I'll give you an example of how stupid this concept is. Michael Bloomberg. billionaire extraordinaire, former mayor of New York City, entered the presidential election. Michael Bloomberg hired the best PR people money can buy. He poured $500 million into this. He had people who were experts at shaping, you know, the image, internet manipulation, social media advertising, direct access. He had his own damn media company. He built this whole thing, and he got him what? 2 electoral votes? $500 million? 2 electoral votes. The Russians, you know, poured in, I don't know, by some accounts, maybe a couple million dollars, by some accounts, in a haphazard fashion. And many times, you know, the ads came up after the fact, so there's no way there could have been a cause-effect relationship. But somehow the Russians, with a few million dollars of really poorly placed ads on the internet, won a damn election. But Michael Bloomberg, with the best team of PR people with $500 million, could only get 2 electoral votes. How does that happen? And the point is, the Russians didn't do anything.
I agree. Literally. I mean, I've seen those ads. They're not witty or clever or anything, so it's not likely. Yeah. So,
and plus, how disrespectful of the average American can you be? You know, Scott Ritter, hey, I'm Facebook. Oh my God. I got to change everything and vote Trump. I mean, no, it doesn't work that way. You vote Trump because you go, Hillary's the worst person in the world. Or you voted Clinton because you said Trump is the worst person in the world. But the thing that made you come to that conclusion was a lifetime of experience, not a 30-second exposure to a damn Facebook ad.
Well, speaking of a lifetime of experience, Joe Biden has been on the scene for many years. And before he began to diminish cognitively, he revealed who he is many times. And you actually tangled with him, I believe, and when you had the Senate hearing in front of him. Was that after you resigned from the UN?
After I resigned, yeah.
Right. And that was meant
September 3rd, 1998.
Yeah. You know, I think I might even have a clip of that. Should we relive that?
Oh, dear. Sure.
The major's assessment is, privately held but publicly acknowledged later, that airstrikes alone aren't going to do this. Saddam's not going to cave on this. So, now here's the deal. I recommended the president have at it and let the chips fall where they may. A reasonable position for the Secretary of Defense and the Secretary of State to take. But I respectfully suggest, Major, I respectfully suggest they have a responsibility slightly above your pay grade. Slightly above your pay grade. To decide whether or not to take the nation to war alone. Or to take the nation to war partway. Or to take the nation to war halfway. That's a real tough decision. That's why they get paid the big bucks. That's why they get the limos and you don't. We should make a decision. But in terms of whether the Secretary of State has no more to consider than you do as the arms inspector, you didn't get in, didn't get my job done, get me in. Period. You made the deal, right? That's the deal. A deal's a deal. Get me in. Scott Ritter, I'm ready to go. That's not how it works. Now, maybe it should work that way. But wouldn't you acknowledge that if you were President of the United States or the Secretary of State, you'd sit there and say, now, okay, old Scotty boy didn't get in. We said he should get in. We want him to get in. It's important that he does get in. They're not going to let him in. So what are we going to do now?
Hey, he's been saying, here's the deal for many years.
Yeah, he's, you know, what he left out of that is that Scotty boy, before that inspection, traveled to the White House. Briefed the White House on every aspect of the mission, got the White House a stamp of approval, a guarantee of support. We went to the State Department, got Madeleine Albright's stamp of approval, guarantee of support. We got the Secretary of Defense's stamp of approval, guarantee of support. So when Scotty Boy showed up at the facility and knocked on the door and they didn't let him in, nobody was taken by surprise. In fact, they all wanted that to happen. They just chickened out. You know what else that Biden didn't say? You know who should have been sitting next to me during that hearing? Madeleine Albright and Cohen, Secretary of Defense. You know why they weren't going to sit next to me? Because Scotty Boy knew everything. Scotty Boy had all the receipts. Scotty Boy had been to all the meetings. And Scotty Boy would have made a damn fool out of Mulbright and Cohen because they couldn't say anything without me saying, no, that's not what happened. They ran away from that hearing. And Biden was pissed that the hearing took place. The reason why he was speaking is because he tried a parliamentary maneuver to shut down the Senate the day I was supposed to testify. But he got outflanked by Trent Lott, who literally closed the Senate down and then restarted it, therefore restarting the Senate clock from a parliamentary standpoint, walked me in to the meeting, and Biden was seething. And the other thing that people don't understand is he got grilled for that performance, hammered. Every newspaper wrote an op-ed piece saying, shame on you. And you know what else happened? He picked up the phone and he called me. I got invited back for a one-on-one with him where he apologized. Wrote me a nice letter of apology. Biden's just a fool. He's always been a fool. He's always been pompous. He's always shot out of the mouth. And he doesn't have any control of facts. An average person watching that videotape would have said, yeah, Biden's in control of the facts. He knows the narrative. He knew nothing. He knew nothing. He didn't know anything about what I had done, what I was trying to do. He was simply trying to score political points. He was trying to create the perception that would offset reality. And he's been doing that ever since. He did that in Afghanistan with this horrific withdrawal. And he's doing it now, trying to create a perception of a Russia that is a out-of-control war criminal state. When the reality is, it's the United States that's backing this Nazi-empowering, pathetic loser of a president, Zelensky, in Ukraine.
Yeah, well, that's why, I mean, other than, I wanted to see if it would make your head explode if I showed you this. But,
well, I mean,
it looked like you were going to strangle him there. Is that what you were thinking when they had that close-up on you, like glaring at him?
I had been told in advance that some senators may say things that piss me off. Mm-hmm. And when that happens, don't say anything. Just keep your mouth shut and stare at them. And that's all I did is I just said, I'm not saying, I'm just going to let you speak. I'm not going to say anything. And you're done because he's a senator. And if you respond, then he's now in control. He's in your decision-making cycle. He acted, you've reacted, you've lost that battle. But if he's just speaking and you say nothing, eventually he has to shut up. And then when that happens, the mic gets turned over to someone else. And he just lost that battle because now he's a prisoner to his own narrative, a prisoner to his own transcript. And that's what happened with Joe Biden. He lost because I didn't say a damn thing in response.
Right. And John McCain stood up for you after that, right?
My friend John, and we're not friends, but no, John McCain did. Chuck Hagel did. Virtually every senator did. They all came out. And I mean, you know, I think the one I like best was Chuck Hagel saying, maybe if we'd listened to more people of your grade, pay grade back in Vietnam, less bodies would come home body bag.
Okay.
You know, okay. Well, I like that one.
We said he should get in. We want him to get in. It's important that he does get in.
All right, I'm just fooling around with you. So, no, the other reason I wanted to play that is to kind of bring it back to the present day. And just if we can just close by drilling down a little bit more on the degree to which we think Biden is a willing participant in this propaganda, because I'm still a little bit fuzzy on that and how you feel about that.
Well, I mean, again, there's only two possibilities. One is that he knows that the CIA is carrying out an information operation, covert, that had to have the backing of the President of the United States, I mean, a presidential finding that he signed. So he can't pretend. I mean, maybe he's lost all cognitive ability. He doesn't realize that he signed it. But the bottom line is he signed a presidential finding authorizing the CIA to carry out an information operation in concert with the Ukrainian military, the propaganda, the 72nd directorate, whose job is to shape public opinion by painting Russia as war criminals. And in doing so, now they've taken a known war crime, which is, I think, the slaughter of these civilians in Bucha is a known war crime. But they've painted it so that it looks like the Russians did it, when in fact everybody knows the Ukrainians did. The Ukrainians know. Even Zelensky, to show you how stupid he is, he made a speech about safari. He said the Russians have gone on a safari. Well, you know what the irony is? You know what the nickname of the National Police Unit that carried out the cleansing operation? Safari. It's a safari team. So Zelensky knows what the truth is. He's just flipping it to, right. You know, but he, you know, he can't escape his own reality, which is he authorized the National Police of Ukraine to go in with their safari team and murder, cleanse collaborators and pro-Russian, the, you know, members of the population. And now they're flipping the script. Does Biden know that that's what took place? I don't know. I mean, he knows that that's the potential. He should be calling in the CIA saying, what's the score here? So either the CIA has told him that we're flipping the script as part of the strategy of making Putin look bad, or the CIA has remained silent. Biden's an unwitting participant. If it's the first, Biden's a war criminal. Again, find me a lawyer that tells me that you won't. You can't. He's a war criminal. He is actively participating. Did Joseph Goebbels pull a trigger? No. Would he have been found guilty? Yes. There are many people who were found guilty and hung by the neck until dead who didn't pull the trigger. But they were in the part of the process of creating, of empowering Nazi ideology, of encouraging these policies, of implementing the policies by paper. That's Joe Biden. Joe Biden is a war criminal. Joe Biden should be arrested. Joe Biden should go to The Hague. And guess what? If he did, he'd be found guilty. He has no defense except that America is the exceptional superpower and nobody will ever hold us to account.
Right. And you mentioned that you're predicting that Russia will hold some war criminals accountable.
Oh, yeah.
And you also articulated very clearly where the line should be drawn and what is or is not a war crime. But on a more practical level, you know, I think people hear about The Hague and they hear about the UN Security Council and the Geneva Conventions and the International Criminal Court and all these things. And they go, but does any of it actually mean anything? I mean, other than you're predicting Russia will hold them accountable. And then this doctrine of preemption seems like it can be reconfigured to fit the circumstances. On a practical level, to what extent are the various military units that represent each nation throughout the globe willing to uphold these principles?
Well, let's make it clear. If Biden's fantasy of the Russian people rising up and removing Vladimir Putin came true, and they now had him in custody, and the United States said, if you want sanctions to be lifted, if you want to come back into the family of nations, you must turn Putin and the following people over to a court of jurisdiction, whether it's the ICC or the ICJ, and to be prosecuted as war criminals. And the follow-on Russian government said, yeah, we're going to do that. Here they are. Then you could see Putin in the docket. But Putin today has, you know, 83% approval rating. I just don't see that happening. Plus, I don't see Russia losing this war. Russia's going to win this war. I don't see the Russian economy collapsing, just the opposite. There will never be. It's a pure fantasy to think about. Let's say the Russians did commit war crimes, that they would appear before a court of jurisdiction to be held accountable. First of all, they could not be successfully prosecuted because no crimes have been committed. So even if Putin was turned over, you can't find a court that would find him guilty because you got to answer all the elements. And, you know, he has articulated a cognizable case for justification for military action. And there's no intent. In fact, just the opposite. We know that the Russian government has issued orders for the Russian troops to come in softly to avoid unnecessary loss of civilian life, to avoid unnecessary damage to civilian infrastructure. And we can clearly point to the prosecution of this campaign to back this up. The only damage that's taking place to civilian property is when the Ukrainians dig in. How do we know that? The Washington Post, who doesn't want to come out in favor of Putin, sent a reporter in, and he came back and said, yeah, it's sort of an uncomfortable truth, but Ukrainians are, they're the ones causing this problem. They're using the people as human shields. They're making the decisions that lead to the destruction of, and that's a war crime. And even, you know, and it's funny because even the article said, he said this without wanting to say this. You know, we don't want to admit they're committing war crimes, but they're committing war crimes. This is the truth. And so Putin would never be convicted. Now, this war is done in a manner which doesn't result in the defeat of the Ukrainian government, then I don't think the Ukrainian government will be held accountable. I think Russia is now going to finish this war so that there is no more Ukraine. I believe at some point in time they're going to arrest Zelensky or seek to arrest him. They're going to arrest every member of his government they can, and Russia will have a court of jurisdiction. That is the Russian court. And these guys are going to go before the Russian court, and Russia is going to have a field day because Russia has all the receipts. They have the intercepted communications. They have the documents. They'll have confessions. They'll have everything, the video evidence, the forensic evidence. The Russians right now are crawling through Mariupol with forensic investigators collecting all the data necessary to hold to account the people responsible for the death and destruction of Mariupol. There will be trials. It will be the trial of the century, because this will make the Nuremberg trials not pale in comparison, but it'll be similar to the Nuremberg trials in scope and scale. And it's going to be a hugely embarrassing moment for the United States and for the West, because even though our media will seek to spin it, you can't spin away the truth. And the truth will out. And in the case of the war in Iraq, the truth will be that the Ukrainians are not only empowering odious neo-Nazi ideology, but they let it loose on the Ukrainian people. It is the Ukrainian government that is killing the Ukrainian people, not the Russians.
Does Putin want Zelensky alive, or is he a target?
Well, I don't have a direct line to Putin, so it's pure speculation right now. But I would say this: some of the demands, and you know, because victory is inevitable, meaning that whatever the Russians want victory to look like is what victory is going to look like. If the Russians decide that they just want Crimea and they want Lugansk and Donetsk to be independent, fine. If the Russians decide that they want to expand Donetsk to include Mariupol and the entire Azov coast, fine. They're going to do that. If they want to take over Odessa and create Novaya Russia, this new Russian entity, to never again allow Russian speakers to live under the Ukrainian rule, they're going to do that. If they want to carve out Western Ukraine and give it to the Poles, if they want to give part of it to the Hungarians and part to the Romanians, the Russians are going to do whatever they want to do because they're going to win that kind of victory. The problem is, if they do that and they don't have the Ukrainian government through a surrender document saying, we agree, then the world will never recognize it. And then Russia will be living with that reality that the world will continue to sanction, et cetera, based upon their actions. Zelensky went into this conflict, and a lot of people don't see this. He was a president prior to the war that had a 23% approval rating. He was elected with 76, 78%, somewhere along that lines. So he has collapsed, 23%. He's a president who arrested all of his political opponents. He's a president that shut down all of the opposition media, meaning anybody wants to say this is Mr. Democracy, can't, because he's not. He's the opposite of it. And because he was such a weakened individual, he's a president that not only went to bed with neo-Nazis, but empowered them, brought them into the totality of governance, from the military to the police to his actual government. So he is the living embodiment of a pathetic, failed leader. And yet, because of this wonderful propaganda machine, he's been turned into Winston Churchill. He's been turned into the modern version of King Leonidas in the 300, standing up against the brutal Xerxes and the immortals. And you have to say, well, wait a minute, how did this happen? Because it's a fair question. How did this happen? What's the first thing you do when you go to war? I'll tell you what the first thing we did when we went to war against Iraq. We knocked out all the communications, all of it, boom. Why? Command and control. You don't want people talking. You don't want the commander to be able to talk to his people. The last thing, why did the Turkish coup fail in 2016? Because the Turkish army failed to shut down the ability of Erdogan to communicate using FaceTime or whatever he used to talk to the Turkish people. If they had shut that off, there would have been no appeal. There would have been no rising in the street. It would have been over. That's what you do. You shut down comms, you shut down the ability to communicate, you shut down the ability to travel. you keep seeing on CNN, you know, the trains are running, the trains are evacuating people, the trains are bringing supplies, and the trains are bringing in politicians from overseas. From Europe. Why didn't they shut down? Why are bridges still up? The only bridges that have been blown up in Ukraine are the bridges blown up by the Ukrainian military, not by the Russians. And the answer is that the Russians don't want to do this. One, they don't want to impact civilian infrastructure. But two, why would you let Zelensky speak to the U.S. Congress knowing that the outcome is $500 million worth of U.S. aid? Why would you let Zelensky speak to the European Union or to NATO knowing that the outcome is going to be nearly $1 billion in military aid? Why would you let him speak to the British Parliament? And the answer is because in doing so, it's a trap. You've just made Zelensky into a credible political figure that the West can't ignore if and when the time comes for him to sign a surrender document that gives Russia everything they want. A failed politician, a 23% politician who is considered by the world to be a failure, doesn't have the legitimacy to sign that kind of surrender document. In fact, he would have been replaced by now. We know that NATO is setting up a provisional government in Warsaw. We know that. They've admitted it. It's being built right now. But they can't activate that as long as Zelensky is in Kiev operating the levers of the presidency. So the Russians have empowered Zelensky to be the man that can give them the surrender they need to have. Because if Zelensky signs a surrender document that says Crimea is Russia in perpetuity, that Donetsk and Donbass are independent, inclusive of Mariupol, and Odessa is now an independent part, what is the world going to say? The world's already committed. Whatever you agree to, they say, we will accept.
Right. Well, I think that explains the video clip that we saw earlier when Zelensky was trying to blame Russia for so-called war crimes. I don't know who those people were, but there are various people sticking microphones in his place, and he seemed pretty vulnerable out in the open. But I think what you just said explains it. He's not really a target at this point.
No, look, if the Russians wanted Zelensky dead, he'd be dead today. And they're not going to send a 25-man hit squad. I mean, that's another one of the great city of 3.1 million with 100,000 soldiers and 600,000 police and motivated civilians running neighborhood watches. And you're going to smuggle 25 Russian Spetsnaz into Kiev to assassinate Zelensky. Ain't going to happen. Didn't happen. That's not how the Russians would operate. You kill Zelensky by taking a missile and you put it into his bedroom window, and you kill him. You drop the office of the president. You drop the whole building. Legitimate target of war. But they're not doing that because they need him alive for the surrender. It's going to happen.
I think we've taken up enough of your time. I want to thank you very much for another great interview. It's just nonstop with you. We're very fortunate to have you and very appreciative that you joined us today. And hopefully we can do it again soon. I'd also like to thank our producer, Tori Mansfield. And I also want to mention that U.S. Tour of Duty is offering a free podcast to anybody who wants to host or produce their own podcast or contribute to ours. And if you would like more information about that, go to our website, which is ustouroftheduty.org. And Scott, have a good day. We'll get you back soon, I hope.
Anytime.
Thank you so much.